She glanced up at the great broken tower columns of the vanished nave of the Abbey Church. Would other girls, all the way down the centuries, she thought, look up at those two stupendous pillars and fill the space between them in their sad imagination with the high carved arch full of wafted incense and choir echoes and choir echoes and deep voiced prayers. Would other girls?
A reading life, a writing life, with writer and teacher Sally Bailey.
I'm in search of a cuckoo. Yesterday the cuckoo was out. Today she's on sabbatical, and I'm standing here waiting and waiting. But what is out is a rather fierce gander. Mr. Gander is protecting his goose, who is laying her eggs between my boat and my neighbour's boat, between my boat and Maeve's boat. She's sitting there like a queenly goose on a rather large tree stump. And Mr. Gander keeps wandering up and down this part of the meadow, this precinct, with his feathers looking very ready to ruffle. There he is. He looks like a clerical sentinel, a man of the church, at least the top part of him. The bottom part of him looks a bit rougher. Ooh, I'm approaching him, and he's not happy about that. He's moving away. He's moving away in the direction of potential further intruders. I'm going to walk slowly down the boardwalk to visit his partner, Lady Goose. There she is. Oh, she's turned around. She's now facing the river. And she's opening and closing her beak as though she were communicating with her eggs, perhaps. She looks rather round and plump, like a goose pudding, ensconced in the ridge of the willow tree bough. She also looks like a guardian, a goosey guardian of place. She's talking to herself, her beak is moving, open and close, she's chatting away, her goosey pregnant mantra. Perhaps she's talking to her future goslings. They haven't been quite so loud in the morning since they've settled down into their domicile, their tree arboreal domicile. I'm walking back down now towards the gander, who is very near the entrance to my boat. I sometimes think that herons look like dispossessed clerics. I wouldn't say that Mr. Gander is dispossessed of his flock, of his church. Exactly. He looks very self-possessed. very intent on guarding, is Mr. Goose, Mr. Gander, I should say. Morning. Morning. And I'm listening to the sound of the birds, which are getting louder and louder as we move into May. And the colours are getting sharper and brighter. For today, this morning, it is finally sunny. And I'm looking through my kitchen window, the window of my boat, Cerrion, meaning beloved in Welsh, and the trees are filled with light. The shapes of the branches, which seem to open up like arms, holding pale blue light. And there is light flickering on my ceiling in shafts too. Boxy light flickering, the shape of boxes like a cinema screen. I call it boat cinema, that flickering light on the ceiling. Carrying itself from outside to in. My boat is a kind of container for light. A sort of natural cinema. But to go back to the branches of the willow tree leaning over on the other side of the riverbank. It seems to have purpose, the shape and direction of its lean and its bend. And as I look today with the light filtering through and the olive green leaves patterned behind against the pale blue sky, I think of stained glass windows and I think of churches and I think of our need for structure, for visual and sonic structure. Not just writers, not just readers, not just artists, but all of us. It comes out of our body. It comes out of our body life. The structure of our toes, I'm looking at mine now, and the small bones running up into my foot as I flex it back and forth, back and forth. It has a webby structure. My toes are small branches leading off towards my foot. The central structure. Everything in human life is structured, and without it, we flail about. We flail, we squawk, we quack, like the ducks outside my boat. And I am still reading that epic from 1932 by John Cooper Powys, A Glastonbury Romance. And I feel as I read this novel in small parts that I'm trekking across soft and sometimes hard or thorny turf. I've come to a part where the young Mary Crow, who is one of the local gals around the community in Glastonbury, around the plains of Glastonbury, Mary Crow is communing with the great broken tower columns of the vanished nave of the Abbey Church. And over again, the characters in Cooper Powys's book are looking for meaning, looking for structure, looking for symbols, looking for shapes around which they can organize their own thoughts, their mind. And Mary is voicing exactly what I've been thinking about as my voice comes and goes, wafting away from me upon a thought filled with, I hope, imagination. I hope not always too sad. Perhaps with a waft of incense. Perhaps with an echo or two. Mary is voicing what I believe to be true, which is that all of us imagining beings, all of us writers, all of us readers, all of us thinkers, anyone who communicates or who's looking for deep communication is also looking for symbolic structure, shapes around which we can organize the thoughts of our characters, the thoughts of ourselves, our own muddled, echoey, repeated, wafting feelings. Thoughts and feelings. Because thoughts are always centered with feeling. And I'm looking now at a painting which is aligned with my morning foot, let's call it. The foot in front of me, which belongs to my leg, which runs up past my knee, which runs into my thigh, over my abdomen, my stomach, up my chest, my neck, to my mouth, which is now speaking to you. And my eyes, my nose, my eyes, are taking in a painting, a symbolic painting, painted by the daughter of an old friend of mine. After I wrote one of my books, No Boys Play Here. And at the top of the composition is a pale, pink, fleshy rose. Blousy, opening up, pert, speaking like a pale pink mouth. And beneath that rose is a girl, very pale, ghostly, with strawberry blonde hair, wide eyelids like shells. And long eyelashes, like spider's legs, and a pert, tightly closed, red rosebud mouth. Heart-shaped her face, heart-shaped. And around her, running through her hair, which suddenly seems to me to look like fire, flamey, are three Boys, twisting and tugging her hair, turning her chin this way and that, one to the left, one to the right, and one to the bottom. The one at the bottom seems to be nudging her awake from her soporific dreams. But the pale girl keeps her eyes tightly closed. And I am thinking of Alice in Wonderland, who refuses to wake until she has sorted out all that nonsense and tried to make sense of the scurrying signs and symbols of Wonderland. And it seems to me as though those three cheeky demons running through the hair of this pale blonde ghost are trying to disturb her from her dreams, but she won't have it. She won't have it. And I see, for the first time, an extra limb emerging from the side of her hair, her head, and one of the demons is pulling at it, a small, pale arm. He is toying with that arm. and there are four slender fingers raised up like tiny candelabra towards his face, towards the dark, brown, peaty, soil-coloured background, upon which the entire symbolic composition sits and dreams away. And it's hard not to look at this painting and see something, to immediately clasp together the pale face of the girl, the shell-like eyes, the budding pale pink rose sitting upon her temple, the flamy coloured hair that is hers, and the deep orange-coloured hair of the three demons, which also reminds me of fire. It is hard not to look at this painting and see things. Meaning. And as I read of Mary Crow and her search for meaning, I am still thinking about the significance of visual language, our search for meaning through symbols, signs and portents. Mary Crow situates herself alongside the echoes and the voices and the heart-filled prayers and the wafted incense and the choir echoes and the deep-voiced prayers of other girls who had looked up at those two stupendous pillars, she thought. Would other girls, all the way down the centuries, would other girls, all the way down the centuries, look up at those two stupendous pillars and fill the space between them with their thoughts? Because that is what we do inside grand spaces, wide spaces, the spaces of church and towers, tall columns and pillars. That is what those spaces are for. And even in this small space of my boat, crouched down as I am, between the base of my bed and the starboard side of my boat, my wooden panels, which feels today like a church pew, even in that small space, I feel something questioning, something asking me to know. This little space in which I sit, this space running between bed and river bank, is a place of questioning. It's a place of asking myself, what is it I hope to know? What is it I hope to have? What is it I hope from him or her?
Thank you for listening to A Reading Life, A Writing Life.